Perfect. Thank you so much. So just as a little background on myself, it's so far to this date, I've sort of worked on a multitude of different types of projects. I think I started out doing some CMB work, searching for non-Gaussianity. And then I started to do a little bit of things of searching for dark matter using intensity mapping and using actually the CMB and intensity mapping to constrain an anomalous signal from the edges back in 2019. And then I just neutrino things, and it somehow sort of ended up to me entering this realm of a little bit of time domain astronomy, which I didn't expect for sure at the beginning of my PhD, but I find it to be a fairly interesting avenue to pursue moving forward, and hopefully you'll see why that is through this talk. And so in order to start off, the natural set of questions, first set of questions are, what are AGN and how do they vary? And as depicted in this cartoon, an active galactic nucleus, or AGN, is composed of some extremely massive compact object, an accretion disk, and a very bright jet that runs parallel to its angular momentum vector. Not depicted is a region surrounding this accretion disk with a bunch of dust in the shape of a torus, aptly named the dust torus, that scales out to some number of parsecs. Moreover, in between the dust torus and the accretion disk, there's a somewhat unknown region of ionized dust that emits broad lines of optical and UV light, termed the broad line region. AGN variability refers to the observation that the intensity of most AGN varies on timescales from minutes to decades and in frequency bands ranging from radio to gamma ray. For example, on the figure to the right, I show the optical light curve for NGC 5548 from late 1988 to late 1996, so about 8 years or so. From this picture, we can infer that NGC 5548 shows almost no variability on timescales smaller than a few days, but as it goes out to weeks, months, or years, a significant variability can be seen. And while NGC 5548 is only a single AGN, most AGN are observed to show similar trends with variability. To date, most success in describing AGN variability has come from the description of the stochastic nature of such light curves. That is, most AGN light curves can be described by a random walk that reverts to its mean, and NGC 5548 sort of follows this idea, as the light curve seems to jostle around, rise and fall, but never move too far away from a mean value of about 7.4 or so. Mean reverting random walks are more formally called damped random walks, and their modeling requires only two inputs: the amplitude of variation A and the mean variability timescale T bar. To date, no definitive causes of AGN variability have been identified, and even the relationship between AGN parameters and their observed variability is unknown. This mystery has primarily been because previous analyses of AGN variability have been limited either due to small AGN sample size or infrequent visit times, both of which will be remedied with the dawn of Rubin. So therefore, we now ask, what is Rubin? The Vera Rubin Observatory, also known as Rubin and formerly as LSST, is an astronomical observatory currently under construction in Chile, with first light slated for April 2024, as I've been recently told. It'll observe the optical electromagnetic spectrum from 320 to 1080 nanometers in five bands, termed UGRIZY or UGRIZY for short, over the entire southern sky or half of the full sky. Its pixel size is about 0.2 arcsec, with each pixel able to detect objects as faint as 25 mags at 5 sigma. As a result, Rubin will measure the flux of over 10 million AGN. Moreover, each band is going to be visited a different number of times and over the full course of the 10-year survey. And if you can combine every information from each band into one single data point, every pixel will be visited, and thus every AGN will be visited every once 3.5 days or so. So what I mean by that is, if I look at this bottom line right there, the U band would be visited 70 times, the G band 100, so on and so forth. And if I sum up those all numbers up, and then I take 10 years divided by that, I would visit once every 3.5 days. With this huge number of sources, coupled with a fast increase in the number of regular high-frequency observation epochs, Rubin will allow for unparalleled precision in variability analyses. So what I sought to do with this work was to quantify this precision for a single AGN and the full population of Rubin AGN so that we may begin to get a handle on the ability of Rubin to be used in variability studies. In order to do this quantification, I performed an expected information analysis and found the following Rubin sensitivities for the variability amplitude and timescale. First, I show the covariance for such measurements of a single AGNJ with apparent magnitude 22.3, which corresponds to the average AGN apparent magnitude in Rubin's I band. So remember, there's the five bands U, G, R, I, Z, Y. I is just one of those five. The x-axis here is the variability amplitude A sub J I of this AGN, and the y-axis, its observed time scale. So if you want to, I mean, there's a set of fiducial parameters that I take for each of these. So on the bottom, it ranges the fiducial parameters for the variability amplitude from 0.01 to 1.0, and the variability time scale from 3 days to about a year or so. So if I want to read this like series of sub figures, you know, if I wanted to say, well, what is the covariance when I have about 15 a day variability time scale, so half a month, and then a variability amplitude of one, I would go to, you know, to this right above the bottom rightmost subfigure. The black circles indicate one sigma, so 68% confidence intervals, and yellow, two sigma. I note that these results hold for most AGN magnitudes and Rubin frequency bands, not just the I band, and not just 22.3, as the AGN included in this analysis are all assumed to be detected at high signal to noise. So we're not limited by photometric error whatsoever. And if I want to put my cosmologist hat on, we're cosmic variance limited. From this plot, I therefore conclude that AGN will be able to be separated from about 10 up to 10 different time correlation bins. So what I mean by that, and how you could infer that from this figure, that if I go, let's say, to this bottom rightmost plot again for the 3 day variability time scale and amplitude of equal to one, you know, here I see that the errors sort of say that the time scale can be measured from like about 2.5 or so to 3.5. And so that would constitute one bin. And then I would move on to maybe next, which may appear around like a variability time scale of about five or so. It has some error. And then I go on, so on and so forth until I have bins that span the entire variability time scale of Rubin. And so that's how I get about up to 10. So second, I show this covariance for such measurements of the entire Rubin.
I wasn't quite following. Just for me to understand, so each little box, like each panel you're showing. So each box corresponds to a time scale that you're looking for variability. So for your bottom left one, for example, you're correlating the variability on 0.01 days versus 3 days.
0.01 days. No, so at the bottom left one, I think, is what you're saying about. That has a variability amplitude of 0.01 and a variability time scale of t. And this would be the covariance of when you have how well you can extract out parameters a and t bar. If the assumed AGN of magnitude 22.3 in Vero's I band has those fiducial parameters, that's the error that you would measure. So maybe to say a little more, the way you would go about doing this is that, you know, I have some optical light curve. I would take that optical light curve and take its Fourier transform, and I can make a power spectrum from that. The power spectrum is essentially defined by the two parameters A and T, and you can extract out A and T to some fidelity. And this series of plots tells you how well you can extract those parameters. But obviously extracting those parameters, the fidelity with which you can extract them depends on the actual measurements. And so this series of sub-figures tells you how well you'd be able to extract them given the fiducial values. Does that make sense?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, okay, like, right. So I should think of this like in the sense that I take my time stream, my Fourier transform, and then I get like amplitudes at each Fourier mode.
I would construct the power spectrum. And then from there, I would have, essentially, the way that the power spectrum looks is that it's flat at very low frequencies, and then it has a break at about 1 over the variability time scale, and then it starts to fall off in the damp random walk case as 1 over the frequency squared. And so, and you would measure, I mean, I'm not, if you were an analytic person, you would just measure each Fourier mode, power spectrum at each mode, and then somehow infer the two parameters for each one and then create estimators from that. But that may be, that would also, if you, in a realistic setting, you would also need to account for things like de-windowing and whatnot.
Hmm. Okay, great. Thank you.
Hopefully explains what the single AGM scenario is. So I'll move on to what happens when you want to infer information about the entire Rubin AGM population. So this right plot now shows the covariance for such measurements, assuming a relationship between the luminosity, redshift, and variability parameters. So the variability amplitude for each GN is assumed to be constant. This is just a guess, and by no means it's a realistic one, but it is something you can take, and it is simple, and why not? While for the variability amp or variability time scale, we take that it goes as a power law in the bolometric luminosity L with index beta. You may notice here that there are superscripts indicating R and O on the variability time scale. That simply indicates a difference between the rest frame variability time scale and the observed frame variability time scale, the difference of which can be accounted from a cosmological expansion, and hence why we include a factor of 1 plus Z. The x-axis in the bottom plots are now the variability time scale index beta, while, and they have fiducial parameters ranging from 0.1 to about 0.5 or so, while the y-axis is the variability time scale norm, now T bar R. And I only take it for 30 days and 100 days, not all the ones that you see on the left, just because the plots don't really change and it's not as interesting to see the same thing so many times. Again, this holds for not just the I band, but all bands, and Rubin's not limited by instrumental noise. Also, when making these plots, I take essentially A sub B equal to 1. If you wanted to consider other scenarios, it just scales as A squared. So it's a pretty easy to take these plots to other cases. Since increases in both the index beta and the norm T bar R lead to increases in the observed variability time scale, they're anti-correlated. And from this plot, you can, well, what I conclude is that a power law relationship will be able to measure to be at best in one part in 100,000 or so. So that's pretty, it's a number you can throw out there. But to give a sense of how good this is, a recent paper actually did an analysis with about 62 AGN, I wanna say, in the optical regime, and found a relationship between the variability time scale and the mass of the AGN to about 1 part in 10 or so. So this would be like a vast, vast increase in a constraining power if in this ideal scenario. But so together, these two plots together, they suggest that with Rubin, precisely measured variability parameters will take their place alongside spectroscopy in the detailed characterization of individual AGN and in the study of AGN population statistics. So moreover, with such precision, we can then use AGN variability as a tool for other analyses. And so this kind of leads me to the second part of this talk about high energy astrophysical neutrinos. And so again, I'll start with the basic question, what are high energy astrophysical neutrinos? In 2013, Ice Cube detected a now 7 sigma discrepancy between the observed neutrino spectrum and that of the modeled energy spectrum of atmospheric neutrinos. So neutrinos that arise from cosmic ray interactions with the atmosphere, as shown in this figure. Atmospheric neutrinos were expected to yield at most 26 events, while Ice Cube saw 54. Once the atmospheric events are removed, what neutrinos are left are termed astrophysical in origin, and still today, we do not know what sources the majority of them. However, we do know a few things, and on the figure to the right, I show the total neutrino flavor differential energy flux plotted against neutrino energy in GeV. The crossbars are the best fitted points to the data, the dotted line, a single power law fit, the red region, the 1 sigma error on this fit, and the dark red region in particular, the observable region for astrophysical neutrinos. from the most recent Ice Cube results, we can then take away three things that describe astrophysical neutrinos. One, they're observed between energies of 10 to the 4 and 10 to the 6 GeV. Two, they follow a power law with spectral index about 2.53. And three, their flux normalization is approximately unity. While these are the main characterizations for this isotropic source of neutrinos, about 4 years ago, we obtained a hint to what may source them. In 2017, IceCube and Fermi detected a neutrino coincident with high blazar gamma ray activity, confirming suspicions that blazars, or more generally AGN, may be a possible source for the bulk of astrophysical neutrinos. Follow-up studies have capped the maximum contribution from known blazars to be about 15% or 20% of the total high-energy astrophysical neutrino flux. As a result, alternative AGN classes that are not as bright, such as radio galaxies, must be considered. A more exotic explanation is that these neutrinos are sourced from cosmic strings. And if I have time, hopefully I do, I'll be able to say definitely some things on this work in progress. But first, I want to talk about the idea that HEN are sourced from AGN, and then if time, I'll say some things about cosmic strings.
You just mentioned that some previous work had capped at 15 or so percent the blazars. Fraction that can come from blazars.
Like, yes, blazars. Yeah.
What's the argument for that? I mean,
what's the origin? Oh, you do
the argument for that. Yeah.
Oh, you do a temporal and spatial cross correlation of the two, and you see that they are not coincident. From just the population of blazars that we observe, yeah.
Okay.
Essentially, I'll say some more details of how to do a temporal spatial cross correlation as it goes down further. But first give a little idea on how AGN are theorized to produce HEN. The first method of neutrino production is the emission of cosmic ray protons from AGN jets that then interact with soft photons to produce mesons, in particular pions, and this method is called photohedronic production. The photons are obviously the squiggly lines. The second method of neutrino production occurs when these cosmic ray protons interact with nuclei in clouds of dust in either the broad line region or even further out in the dusty torus, and once again, they produce mesons and particularly pions. This method is called hadronuclear production. In both cases, the pions then decay into gamma rays and neutrinos via the processes shown here. So now I'll talk about how to characterize the AGN contribution to high energy astrophysical neutrinos. So first, remember, blazars and other extremely bright AGN cannot contribute to the entire HEN background. And so therefore, it must be less bright AGN to do so. Since any given AGN is not extremely bright, a population analysis must be done. What I propose is to use Rubin to measure the intensity catalog of the 10 million or so AGN, which is a 10-time improvement over the last version of SDSS. In addition, because you can't just have a catalog of AGN, you add to this intensity measurements, IceCube, Baikal GVD, and KM3Net. So each of these are neutrino telescopes. IceCube has been around for about 10 years. KM3Net and Baikal GVD are same generation, but haven't quite yet been finished. Hopefully they will be in full operation within the next 2 to 3 years or so. So that would align with the start date of Rubin. And each of them have the same collection area. However, KM3Net and Baikal GVD are both located in fresh water. In particular, Baikal GVD is located in Baikal Lake in Russia, which is the fun trivia fact, largest freshwater lake in the world. It's like the size of Bulgaria, and it contains like 23% of all the freshwater on Earth. It's a cute little information, but because they're located in fresh water, they have much more precise measurements compared to the South Pole, which is actually fairly dirty, the ice there. And this fresh water allows them to have twice the angular precision over IceCube. So obviously with this increase in number of data points, it's natural to propose cross-correlating these two future data sets to determine how many high-energy astrophysical neutrinos can come from AGN in this catalog. And so how do you do this? You have a cross-correlation that's temporal and spatial, and Neela, I think this will hopefully clarify what I was talking about earlier and what they did in the Blazar case, but now we're just proposing to do for these future things with more telescopes and a different AGN catalog. So the first thing is temporal. So you have the variability delta J, where delta J is just defined to be the, you have AGN J and it has some intensity I sub J. You subtract out the mean I bar and you divide that quantity by I bar. So it's like the fractional variation. And that's represented by the black curve for some example AGN. And then in the orange, you have, or the orange arrows represent the variability of AGN J at the time of a neutrino arrival. So your null hypothesis would be, you know, if AGN and neutrinos have nothing to do with one another, you know, then when the neutrino arrives, it has nothing to do with whatever activity is happening in the AGN, you know, whether the AGN is flaring, whether it's dormant, whatever is happening, it's just not correlated. So if I take the value of the variability at the neutrino arrival times and I sum them all up, I should get zero, because sometimes it's they're above it and sometimes they're below it. But
do you allow for any lag between the neutrino
in this analysis right now, I'm not including any lag, but it's good you mention it, because I, in future work, what I want to do is actually to use lag, because I think lag will be very important in maybe determining where in AGN neutrinos can be formed, because we have already an idea that, we already know that higher frequency light comes from more central regions in an AGN. So like really, really close to the corona and whatnot, you've got like X-rays and gamma rays and whatnot, but further out, you've got radio typically. And so if I observe a lag in time between, let's say, the neutrino event arrival times and let's say the optical regime, then it gives me an idea of where actually these neutrinos could be coming from. Because, you know, there's going to be some time delay in between when that signal from inner parts is going to go to the outer parts. So it's definitely, I think, it's an interesting question to have. And it's, but right now I'm not, I'm just setting time the lag to be zero, just for simplicity. But so the other thing, so the temporal signal you would register if you had a correlation, you would observe some like correlation between, you know, flaring and arrival times, but you also have a spatial case. And the spatial case can be shown on the right figure. The orange dots are the neutrinos, the light blue dots are the AGN, and the black circles kind of depict the angular error of whatever neutrino telescope you want to take. This is just a cartoon. The realistic numbers are that the angular error for IceCube is about 0.5 degrees. For KM3Net and Baikal GVD, it's about 0.25. And per sort of circle on the sky for IceCube, at least, you should see about 15 or 20 AGN. So the way you would do this
Can I stop you again? As a hand raised, Asubhadeep, yes. Can you go ahead?
Hi, thanks. Hi, Salik, an interesting idea. So when you do the time-driven cross-correlation, special cross-correlation, you have to choose these time bins very carefully. There are a couple of time scales involved, right? Yeah. One is the time scale at which the noise is varying, and you need to integrate it out to beat the error, but you should not miss the signal either. So yeah. How do you do that?
Let's say you're observing variability on timescales of about months or so. So if you're observing variability timescales for months or so, I wouldn't say there's much worry about missing that signal. And also, I should say, if you look at the SNR plots, you aren't going to be able to measure variability that's less than a few days or so. So there, in that case, yeah, you've got no hope there. But for a month or so, you have the bin of the time series, and I don't think you need to worry too much that you're not going to be capturing the signal. I mean, you also won't capture the signal if the variability is going to be much. Once you start to get to about 3 years or so variability time scales, you're not going to be able to do very good measurements.
If your neutrinos are emitted at the same time, that will be within a small time domain, right? That when you're correlating between those two, will be a choice of binning will be significantly important, I guess.
So you're saying that if I have a neutrino time bin, I mean, the time bin of neutrinos is very small compared to
that's right.
So if the time scale of variation is comparable to the neutrino time bin. Yeah, there's gonna be some worry, but the neutrino time bins are extremely small. They're extremely small. I don't think there needs to be worry about that, at least.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, but good question, yeah. So going back to the spatial case, your null hypothesis is going to be that they aren't related whatsoever. A neutrino isn't necessarily going to be related to where the locations of the AGN are, and so you'll have some just isotropic signal that you need to distinguish from. But if neutrinos do in fact come from AGN, they will typically overlap on one another more often than not, I mean, up to the angular error. And so you can just distinguish just by seeing how often neutrino positions with their angular error overlap with AGN. And so that's how you do the spatial correlation. And that's how exactly most of the, I'll say that later, but this is essentially what was done for the detection of TXS 056056, the first neutrino coincident with the blazar activity. They just saw that, the neutrino was right there and then the blazar was right there. And that was pretty much the end of the story. That's how they got that conclusion. But once you have these cross correlations, you may wonder, how well will we be able to detect the fraction of neutrinos that actually come from AGN? And so that's what I'm going to show here with this expected information analysis once again. So the x-axis again is the neutrino the fraction of high energy astrophysical neutrinos that come from AGN. And then the y-axis, the signal to noise, which you can measure this fraction F. The light blue curve is what happens when you try and infer this fraction F only using spatial data, so only the spatial cross correlation. And it's pretty nice. If you at least consider one sigma measurements, you can go down to about fractions of about 3% or so. And even if you go to 3 sigma, that's about 10%. So considering that AGN are a fairly prospective source for these neutrinos, and in conjunction with a large number of AGN that will be observed with Rubin, this sort of tells me at least that, yeah, we're going to be able to really start to see a lot more coincidences in this next decade. And then this green line here is a simultaneous temporal and spatial correlation. So this is not necessarily adding both time and space, but you might be able to take a little pause here, because you notice that if I add this T if I had time to space, then I somehow get a signal to noise that's smaller. And to explain that is because this curve is trying to measure the neutrino fraction F under the hypothesis that variability of an AGN is somehow related to the neutrino arrival times. And inferring the fraction F under this assumption is intrinsically linked to the amplitude of the variability. If I see an AGN and it's undergoing very large variability, it's very easy to make a temporal correlation between the two, because it's very easy to see, it's flaring, and now I've seen a neutrino. I can coincidentally put these two events together. But if variability is very tiny, then you won't be able to really make such an inference, and that small variability is actually what kind of leads to this decrease in the SNR with T and N. But under the null hypothesis, you can still combine the green and the blue curves together, and that's what you get from the red curve. I don't show just temporal inferences of F, because timing just won't give any information for AGN. In the case of in case of FRBs, it's much easier to do this because they're just BERTs, and so you just have to temporally locate it. But FRBs right now, at least with the most recent catalogs, have been shown not to be a source of high energy astrophysical neutrinos. But in this case for AGN, when you have long-term variability, it really is intrinsically linked to the amplitude of that variability.
Let me stop you again. There's a hand raised again. Kendrick, go ahead.
Yes.
Oh yeah, I just had one quick question. So
yes.
If you were getting a cross correlation spatially only, as in the blue curve.
Yes.
Then one possible interpretation would be that the some of the neutrinos are coming from AGNs. But an alternative interpretation might be that the neutrinos are coming from some other type of object, which in turn is spatially correlated with the AGNs because of just a large-scale structure correlation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there a way of distinguishing this hypothesis? Besides using temporal.
Besides using what?
besides using temporal information?
Yeah. No, that's definitely a good question. Goodness, could you coming from other things? I think so besides temporal, I would say energy. Probably you would have to start to consider models of production and see if the energy spectrum and content matches up. But besides energy and temporal, I mean, maybe you could do some more analyses of how much the neutrinos are expected to be tracing whatever the large scale structure, and if maybe that actually lines up with what we see. It's definitely a good point. It's definitely a good point, and something that is, I don't have a good answer, I will say. Yeah, but definitely interesting.
But just to follow up on that, right? I mean, so you're thinking about, I guess, TeV neutrinos, and then physically, I guess, you know, should we expect that sources of these TeV neutrinos should also be sources of like TeV photons?
Yeah, gamma ray. Well, so these are going to be neutrinos of about 100 TeV or
100
so,
TeV. But okay.
Yeah, it's about a PeV. But these neutrinos also have gamma rays, so that's what we would observe. And that's what Fermi saw.
Right. Okay. So so in that case, then I suppose that perhaps like other like random galaxies, we might not necessarily worry about, you know, if those galaxies themselves don't generate like PeV photons.
Yeah. So that goes back. Yeah. That goes back to the energy content. You can somewhat maybe distinguish other tracers of the neutrino arrivals due to if your model expects to produce gamma rays. Definitely interesting questions. I should also say that even though the green line is smaller, I shouldn't harp on it too much because it's not too small, and in fact it is still large enough, at least one sigma, that you can still measure fractions of F of about 10% or so. And what that means is that hopefully in this next decade, we'll be able to maybe also ask questions of how neutrinos are produced in AGN, if AGN in fact produce neutrinos. Because in order to actually talk about their production mechanism, you will need to have some temporal analysis to be done. And so that's, I think, that's what that green line kind of tells me, and that this next decade is going to be super interesting to see what's going to happen with neutrinos. But I say that concludes for the AGM portion, and I can now talk a little bit maybe of cosmic strings if I have time.
Sure, but before that, can I just understand, for this previous plot, so to combine the green and the blue curves, you have to know something about the covariance between... So
under the null hypothesis, it's zero covariance.
There's no covariance between...
Under the null hypothesis. So if you assume that neutrinos are not at all related spatially or temporally, there's no worry about the covariance. The covariance matrix is just zero, yeah.
Oh, okay, sorry, say it again. If we assume the neutrinos
that
are not...
So this is a measurement of F distinguishing from the null hypothesis that neutrinos have nothing to do with time, with temporal or timing a coincidence or spatial coincidence. Once you want to actually go and take a measurement of F, you will need to include covariances, because then you are assuming that, yeah, they have some... relationship to one another. But when you are trying to distinguish a signal from nothing, you don't need to worry about a covariance between the temporal and spatial.
I don't have to wait, sorry, to define my detection significance. To define the Y value, I don't need to, you're saying I don't need to worry about the covariance between the blue and green. Okay, sorry. Yeah.
So the noise with which you detect measurements is evaluated under the null hypothesis that they are not at all related. And so what that means is when I take, let's say I do this expected information analysis and I take a measurements of the power spectrum, and one of them is P, one of them is just the spatial portion, and one is the timing with the spatial, then the artificial, the timing portion just averages out to zero under the null hypothesis because they just have no correlation involved. And the main thing is that they're not correlated under the null hypothesis. That's really it.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah. So, so essentially to get to the red curve, you just need to add the blue and the green in quadrature for this simple case. But when you actually want to measure F in real life, you will need to actually worry about covariances for sure. Yes. So the other possible source of high energy astrophysical neutrinos are cosmic strings. So cosmic strings are essentially such it's similar to a shoestring, except these are instead of made of normal matter, they're usually made up of particles that are beyond the standard model, and they can range from lengths from atomic size to galactic and supergalactic sizes. Usually there's some network of strings that's created by some phase transition in the universe, and then these networks undergo crossings and whatnot to form smaller loops. And then it's these loops that are going to be emitting particles that we observe. And in particular, though you can't have a cosmic string just sort of oscillate and emit particles, you need to have some deformation on the string to do so. And the way to at least understand this somewhat, the simplest way that I at least know to understand this is via the Paley-Wiener theorems, which relate the continuity classes of objects to their decay rates in Fourier space. And if you have a continuous curve, then you expect that. So if I have a C infinity curve, then its Fourier transform is going to be exponentially decreasing. But if I have something with a kink or a saddle point, then its Fourier transform will actually start to decay as a power law. And so if you have strings that are just smooth, then you won't observe things very far away. But if you have something that is as a saddle point or whatnot, you will have a power law decay and emission, and thus allow for much more efficient production of particles from an observer. And so the three types of deformations that you can have on the string are going to be cusp, kinks, and kinking collisions. Cusp is just as it says, indicated by the picture. A kink is some just discontinuity, not obviously in the string itself, but in derivatives of the string. And then the last one is a kinking collision. The cups, I should say, emit in a sort of burst-like faction. So cusps are localized in time and space. So you'll have a string that's wobbling kind of like this. And then it'll suddenly form a cusp, shoot stuff out, like a short burst of energy, and then go back to oscillating and do this sort of periodically. A kink will lie on the string and travel around at the speed of light and emit particles as that occurs. And so it'll sort of form a lighthouse as it travels. And a kinking collision, they're just kinks that are hitting along the string, and so just emit isotropically. You have to have specified some model to actually produce neutrinos from this. So the first type of, there's two types of ways you can actually then emit, is one is via direct emission that I'm looking at, and one is indirect emission. So for direct emission, at least the main way that I'm looking right now is via the AB coupling. So if I have, these strings, I'm assuming to be made of some complex scalar that has a gauge field. And this, if you have the neutrinos are charged under this gauge field, there's going to be a coupling that goes as, the gauge field times the neutrino. And so if you have a magnetic flux going along the loop and the magnetic flux of this gauge field, that is, then you can emit out neutrinos from the cosmic string via the AB coupling. A more simpler case maybe is via a scalar-Yukawa interaction where you have the complex scalar somehow connected to the neutrinos. But the one case that you can have is the AB coupling. The indirect emission is instead if you have the complex scalar coupled to some heavy scalar, and that scalar will then be emitted and then undergo a later decay via maybe some strong interactions and whatnot that then finally cascades into neutrinos. You can also have an indirect emission rather than doing a cascade, but let's say a direct emission from, like, you emit some intermediary particle phi that's heavy scalar, and then that decays into neutrinos. That's another case. And those are the four general scenarios that I'm currently investigating to produce high energy asymmetric neutrinos. And the analysis to see can cosmic strings produce high energy asymmetric neutrinos, obviously we do not observe cosmic strings. So you can't do something like a cross correlation between the two. But we do have the energy spectrum of the high energy asymmetric neutrinos. So you can just do a rough thing of seeing, does the spectrum produced by the cosmic strings match up with the spectrum observed? You know, are there any distinct, and also even if they don't match up, are there any distinct features I would be able to possibly search for in high energy astrophysical neutrino spectrum that could indicate a cosmic string production? And this is, again, as I said before, a work in progress, but I can say for the indirect emission with the scalar coupling and the cascade, for the cusp and kink emission, they essentially have a flat spectrum that gets cut off immediately, and the cusp instead has a low energy cutoff that then goes on for much, much higher energy spectrum, but is suppressed relatively. So that's just to say that the spectrum that you observe is typically flat. The cutoff in the reason why the cusp can go on for so much further than the kinks is primarily because the string at the point of the cusp is going relativistic, like speed of light. And so it can just emit particles at very, very high energies, as opposed to the kink and the kink collisions, which are much more non-relativistic and so undergo some cutoff in energy. But my preliminary results at least say that if you try and match the spectrum and whatnot, cosmic strings won't be able to produce more than about like 10% of the total high energy astrophysical neutrino flux. So that I would say is like.
Yes, sorry, I didn't follow. So what's setting the value of that cutoff in your blue curve?
So there's a couple of things that set the cutoff, but the main thing is the minimum loop size, and the minimum loop size is given by, in this case, the inverse of the mass of the intermediary particle. That's really, I'd say, the main, and also the string tension. Those are the two main quantities that set off the cutoff here.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And the string tension could be, I guess, like anything depending on your...
Well, yeah, it needs to be smaller than the bound by the CMB, which is about 10 to the minus 17 in units of G over C to the fourth.
Wait, like G mu? You're saying, wait, what?
The
10 to the minus 17? Really?
Yes. Yeah, the bounds are pretty stringent. But the reason why you can still produce neutrinos, even if the string tension is so small, is, I mean, it's a bit of a mixed thing. One is the fact that you will have the parameter M is actually, that allows you to have large enough amplitude. And then also in other models, the production, and I am actually interested in figuring out why this is, but the production, the spectrum actually depends on the inverse of the string tension. So smaller string tensions produce larger spectra, which is a weird thing for sure. But those are two things that lead you to actually still produce neutrinos, even though you have a small string tension. Also the fact that you have a population of them, so.
Okay, interesting. All right, thanks.
Yeah. So those are the three things that I would say constitute what I've been doing so far, and some future directions of what I've presented. So for AGN and their variability, one thing is that I'm interested in is maybe using that as another type of cosmological tool. In particular, the two things in mind is maybe the possibility of gleaning information about Hubble. So, you know, if I have some relationship between the intrinsic luminosity and the observed variability of AGN, then maybe I can invert that relationship to take variability measurements and turn that into luminosity measurements, and thus infer something about the luminosity distance and hence Hubble would be nice. But even if you don't have that, you could still remember the fact that variability is not going to necessarily be caused only by intrinsic sources in the AGN itself, Because if I have an AGN and it's emitting light, there'll be some micro lenses along the line of sight that'll move past and cause some external variability, which if the signal to noise is large enough, may be able to measure it, and thus you'd be able to infer something about the mass distribution along the line of sight, which also I think is something interesting that I'm interested in looking into to see if that's possible. And aside from the AGN as a sort of a tool, further characterizing the high energy astrophysical neutrino sources would also be nice. So I mentioned, and Neil, you pointed out the fact that time delay is a thing that is cool. But aside from time delay, there's also a subtlety that I did not mention, but it's the fact that I currently have only assumed a linear relationship between the luminosity of the AGN and the number of neutrinos emitted. That doesn't necessarily have to be true. Maybe it's sometimes true in the X-ray regime or in the gamma ray variability, but not necessarily for the optical. And so a nonlinear relationship would obviously spoil any type of correlation that you would naively expect. And so you need to maybe go to higher point statistics to detect that, because, you know, under a nonlinear relationship, the three-point function will be non-zero. Moreover, I did not talk anything about energy bins. That's also a thing. Like, if the signal to noise is still large enough, can you actually start to see information about how high energy astrophysical neutrinos are produced of different energies? Maybe they're produced in different parts of the AGN. Maybe they're produced via different mechanisms. I don't know. But it's, I think, a thing worth looking into. And then, moreover, as another further tool, in this case, I say, you know, in the most simplest of scenarios, neutrinos travel from an AGN to us on a geodesic in a straight line, essentially, and they don't undergo scattering. But if neutrinos, say, let's say, have self-interactions or they interact with dark matter, then possibly, if they interact with neutrinos, they would scatter off of the cosmic neutrino background. If it interacts with dark matter, it would scatter off of dark matter. In either of these cases, temporal and spatial coincidences would be spoiled relative to their zero scattering counterparts. And so maybe, you know, if it's possible to infer detection of dark matter or self-interactions from correlations is also a thing that is, I think, a cute little idea. Aside from this, these two things related to the project, I'm also currently working on something related to charge fluctuations in the universe, which is, if you would like to ask questions on that, I'm more than happy to speak about that too. But I will leave myself right there and not start rambling about random projects.
Okay, awesome. All right, thanks, Cyril. You're right on time, Ethan. Perfect. Okay, so let's all unmute to give him a round of applause for his great talk. Okay, are there any further questions for Cyril? We've had a bunch already, but it's fine if there's more questions, feel free just to jump in.
Yeah, I have a question. So concerning this, neutrino emission from strings.
Yes.
Okay, so you considered cusps and kinks, but what about loop annihilations? Is there this channel?
A loop annihilation. So if I have two loops that then collide and annihilate into the neutrinos?
Well, the big string is wiggling, producing a small loop, you know, like from string crossing, and then the small loops annihilate.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. No, I haven't actually considered anything about the actual loops themselves colliding and annihilating. I haven't thought about that scenario at all. Do you happen to know if any bounds on cross sections of strings annihilating or whatnot?
Well, I think people discuss gravitational waves from this channel.
Okay.
So interesting. Yeah, then okay. I don't know what it will imply for neutrinos.
Yeah, no, that's okay. String loop annihilation. Great, thanks.
Yeah, okay.
Hendrik, I think, has a question as well.
Sure, I'll ask one more quick question. So first, I'd just like to say thanks for a really interesting talk. My quick question is that you're looking for angular cross correlations on L at scales on the order of L of a few hundred,
mm-hmm.
Where large scale clustering might be important. Like the, if you were to plot the auto power spectrum of the AGN, then it may not be Poisson dominated on those scales.
Mm-hmm.
So would that affect your, is that incorporated in your SNR forecasts?
For the neutrino. Yeah, so this is a thing that Mark and I were talking about, and we were trying to be like, is it a thing that really matters or not? And I, through our rough estimations of going through, of seeing what the answer is in each case, I would say my guess is that it's not extremely important, but I can't say that we've done such a systematic check and really gone to the detail that I can say it's 100% not important. It may be, and it's something in the back of my head that I know once I'm going to be doing these further things with the cross correlation, I want to actually go down and, you know, write it out properly. But it is, that's a subtlety. That's for sure.
Thanks.
Yeah. Okay, any further questions? All right, I'm not seeing any. Okay, so then let's stop here.